Thank you, Robert, and the other organisers for inviting me to be here. It's a great pleasure. This is my first proper visit to Canada, and it is lovely to be here and a great privilege to have a chance to talk to you tonight on the topic of our decision making at the very end of life. I'm a palliative care physician. For those of you who aren't familiar with palliative care, I will discuss it a bit further on. Yes, my twang is from Sydney, with the beautiful Harbour Bridge. The church where I met Robert is just there, so I see the harbour every Sunday as I go to church, and it's a beautiful city, and that's my family on holidays last year. The advertised name for this talk is Brave New World, and I chose this because it's the title of a book by Aldous Huxley where he described a utopia where life was easy and life was good. Something that would appeal to many of us, I'm sure, and something that many people think we are well on the way to achieving as our mastery of the material world increases at a great rate. And intrinsic to the idea of a perfect life in the public imagination is perfect health. And that's not a bad thing to hope for. Clearly, as a doctor, I think that promoting health is important, but sometimes there's no more treatment available. And health fails. And what should we do then? The answer we've recently been given by Quebec is legalise euthanasia. And that's what I'd like to consider tonight, the euthanasia debate and what it says about how we approach decision making at the end of life in 2014. As I said, I'm a physician and I work in a palliative care unit in a hospice treating patients who don't have long to live. I also do research, which I will discuss later, and it's a privilege to look after people in their final illness. And I'd like to tell you about a patient I cared for a long time ago. He was about 16 years old. He'd been diagnosed with colon cancer, which is quite unusual. And he'd had his chemotherapy and surgery, and they'd been unable to cure him. So he was sent along to the palliative care unit for supportive care. He'd always wanted to travel to the outback with his father, so we made the arrangements so he could go, and off he went. Sometime later, we heard he was back in the hospital and wanted to see us, so we went along to his room, and it was immediately obvious that things hadn't gone well for him. And he proceeded to tell us just how badly things had been for him, and point by point told us how he was suffering. And he asked for euthanasia. He said, "You wouldn't let a dog suffer like this." Well, my boss sat down beside the bed and took his hand and said, "But you're not a dog. You're a man. And we're going to help you die like a man." I'll come back to this story later, but it's not surprising that euthanasia generates heated debates because it's a life and death issue. At the moment, euthanasia is legal in the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg. In North America, physician-assisted suicide is legal in some of the states as well as Quebec. In the United Kingdom, they are debating legislation yet again, but over 100 Brits have already died through the arrangements in Switzerland. In Australia, the Northern Territory legalised euthanasia in 1995. That law was overturned by the federal Parliament 2 years later. But over there, legislation for euthanasia continues to come before our state parliaments, and we keep debating it, just as is the case in parliaments all over the world. It just keeps coming back. And looking around the internet, there seems to be a lot of public support for these laws. In Canada, apparently, it's 80% of the public support euthanasia. In the United Kingdom, I think it's 77%. In Britain, In America, they're not quite so enthusiastic. I came up with a figure of 56%. But in my own country, apparently 85% of Australians are in favour of euthanasia. However, I have reason to believe that we need to interpret these statistics cautiously. because I've spoken about euthanasia on Talkback Radio many, many times over the years. And, sorry, you can't hear me when I walk? You should be able to hear me, I have a mic.
No, those are two different things.
Okay.
This is for the speaker.
Okay. I need another one.
Right.
Three.
Sorry.
These are all made for men, with pockets and ties. Okay, I'm really wired now. Anyway, when I do this talkback radio late at night in Sydney, and the public phone in with their questions, and it becomes obvious that there are so many misconceptions about what the normal practice at the end of life is these days. So I think confusion abounds regarding what the legalisation of euthanasia actually means. So what really happens at the end of life these days? And what does it mean to have the option of euthanasia? And why, at a time when we have better medical care and more cures than at any other time in history, are patients asking their doctors to kill them? Why is this debate happening now? So what I'd like to do this evening is to talk about the definitions involved in this debate, because I think it's the reason for a lot of the confusion. I'll quickly run through the community arguments for and against to bring you all up to speed, though I'm sure the Canadians are fairly familiar with this material at the moment. And then I'd like to try and understand what is really going on at a community level in the context of my own research in cancer patients and our perspective as Christians. Well, the word euthanasia comes from the Greek. It means good death. And that's actually quite unhelpful because both sides claim the advantage of bringing about a good death. In fact, the question of what constitutes a good death is at the heart of the euthanasia debate. We would all like to see people dying with dignity and without suffering. The question is, how do we go about it? I find euthanasia as an act where the doctor intentionally ends the life of a person by the administration of drugs at that person's voluntary and competent request for the reasons of compassion. It's usually because they mistakenly think that's the only way to relieve the suffering. The important point in this is that the act is done on purpose, the patient wasn't pressured, and they were mentally competent at the time of the request. Physician-assisted suicide is the situation where a doctor intentionally helps a person to commit suicide by providing drugs for self-administration at that person's voluntary and competent request. In this situation, a doctor is distanced from the act, but morally it's no different from euthanasia because the motive, intention, and outcome are the same. And so, since they are similar in moral terms, I will use both euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide interchangeably this evening. But to understand the public debate, we also have to realise what euthanasia is not. Euthanasia is often confused with withholding or withdrawing futile or burdensome treatment. When a patient is in the terminal stages of their disease, a time may come when treatments which were aimed at cure either no longer work and they are futile, or else the side effects such as nausea and vomiting are so overwhelming that they may cancel out any benefit of the treatment. And at this stage, the treatment may not be so much prolonging life as prolonging the process of dying. But avoiding or stopping these treatments is not euthanasia because our intention is not to kill the patient, but to allow the underlying disease to run its course. No mentally competent person has to undergo treatments they don't want, even if refusal means that their lives are shortened. We all have that right of refusal. There's no ethical obligation to extend life at any cost. There is no biblical instruction to do so. And euthanasia is not switching off the life support machine, even when we know it will lead to the death of the patient, because it wasn't switching off the machine that killed the patient. It's the underlying disease that kills the patient. That's why they were on life support in the first place. And euthanasia is not the administration of medications needed to ease pain and suffering at the end of life, Some patients with advanced disease do develop distressing symptoms, and we want to relieve that distress. Depending on the nature of the symptoms, the treatment will vary, but sedation or large doses of morphine may be required, but comfort is always the goal. It's not euthanasia because the intention is not to kill the patient, but to relieve the distressing symptoms. Now, some people would say that process is passive euthanasia because of the myth that morphine or sedation shortens the life of the patient. They argue that if we already practice that type of euthanasia, why can't we have the other type of euthanasia, which they call active euthanasia? So you see the problem. The terms are unhelpful. Sadly, it seems to me, as an outsider, that this is what has happened in Quebec. I appreciate the motives, trying to relieve suffering, but I'm horrified at the confusion this will bring regarding normal end-of-life care. The standard use of palliative sedation occurs at the very end of life, when the patient is already actively dying and not expected to last more than a couple of days. If someone is not actively dying and you start deep sedation, you're basically allowing them to starve to death. This is not a legitimate goal of medicine. But the talk about passive euthanasia all began with a myth that the administration of these drugs necessarily shortens the life of the patient. I could have given you a very long list of references here, but we have overwhelming evidence that the therapeutic use of morphine and sedation, given in the doses needed for their clinical effect, does not shorten life. In fact, Good's study in palliative care patients suggested that they may actually increase survival. Refusing life-prolonging treatment and receiving adequate symptom control do not represent euthanasia. They are legal and ethical options which are standard medical practice at the end of life. No laws need to be changed for this care to be given. And when the public has a better understanding of standard end-of-life care, it reduces the call for euthanasia because it allows for less suffering and an increased sense of control for the patient. It also needs to be mentioned that in the places where it is legal, pain is a very uncommon reason why euthanasia is requested. Despair and loneliness, fear of the future and fear of being a burden, anticipated fears more than intolerable circumstances. These are the reasons why people request euthanasia. So it's not a failure of medical care which has led to calls for euthanasia. However, it may be a failure of our support for the terminally ill. It's argued that euthanasia should be legalised as a compassionate response to the suffering of the terminally ill, which is perceived often wrongly to be otherwise unrelievable. It's also argued that a competent individual should have the right to choose the timing and manner of their own death. On the other side of the debate, we have the sanctity of human life argument, the argument that it's unnecessary to introduce euthanasia because palliative care can relieve suffering in the terminally ill, and we're warned of the danger of abuse due to the slippery slope which is created when euthanasia is legalised. Let me unpack these for you. It's true that many people experience pain and suffering when they're dying, and this has led to a situation where too many people have seen a bad death. Perhaps someone was in pain. Perhaps they were without dignity. Perhaps they were in turmoil. And I'm sure in an audience this size, that has been the experience of some people here. This shouldn't happen, but it still does, and it's an important factor for the call for legalisation of euthanasia. It's been the experience of many people who are lobbying most vigorously for the cause. We must do better. To finish off that story, I told you at the beginning, Well, after we all finished crying, we sat down and found out what was really causing the problems for that young man, and we were able to relieve his physical symptoms. And that gave him the space to be able to think and say the important things he wanted to say before he passed away soon after that. I don't know how many dying patients I've looked after, but it must be in the thousands. I would just like to reassure you this evening that at the end of your life, you won't be faced with, on the one hand, pain and suffering or euthanasia on the other. There is a third option, which is why euthanasia is increasingly unnecessary, and that's my specialty of palliative care. The World Health Organization defines palliative care as specialized care for the dying, which affirms life and regards dying as a normal process. It neither hastens nor postpones death. It provides symptom relief for patients and offers a support system to help patients live as actively as possible until death. It offers a support system to help the family cope during the patient's illness and in their bereavement. You have a fine tradition of palliative care in this country. There are still problems with getting it distributed well through the United States. But experiencing pain and suffering at the end of life is not inevitable. With modern medicines and procedures, the majority of patients are free of pain at death. And the WHO has actually developed a pain ladder, which enables up to 90% of patients to be pain-free. And this is a technique that can be learned by general practitioners using this basic approach. Specialist centres like mine achieve even higher results of success. Not everyone needs to see a specialist or visit a hospice, but all dying patients would benefit from palliative care in some form. Sadly, access is still a problem in many places. When I went to university, no one talked about palliative care. It's a relatively new specialty, and a lot of doctors aren't aware of what we can achieve. And because we rarely talk about death in our society, most people are scared of dying and feel a loss of control when their body starts to fail. And it's thought that euthanasia will help you get that control back. But it's not the only way. For example, this is the Advanced Planning website for Canada. Advanced care planning is the way patients can let their doctors know what they would want, what their preferences for healthcare would be if they were no longer able to express themselves or be mentally competent. These are discussions that allow you to document the treatments you do want as well as the things you don't want. And I know that many people think that if they were facing their own death, they would want the option of euthanasia, but evidence suggests that most of them won't. If you look at the people who are actually staring death in the face, people like my patients, most of them think quite differently. A study in Sydney showed that when the number of people when they first come to palliative care units that request euthanasia is 2.8%, and once treatment starts, it falls to less than 1%. Less than 1% of patients persist in their request for euthanasia once their treatment has started. Now, I know I'm going into a lot of detail here, but in order to make an educated, ethical interpretation of euthanasia, we need to know what we're actually dealing with in terms of the facts. And personally, I'm not surprised that such a low number of people persist in their request for euthanasia, because in my experience, people at the end of life are more likely to want more time, not less, if the care is good. And chances are that 85% of Australians in favour of euthanasia were actually quite healthy. They didn't know what it feels like to be at the end of life. And that's quite understandable, because most Westerners don't have much contact with death until well in middle age. Most young people have never seen a corpse. I'm not saying that nobody ever rationally requests euthanasia, just that these public polls are very misleading regarding the extent of public support at the end of life. But we should also realise that the idea that legal euthanasia does give us control is not always true. And this is illustrated by the abuse of legislation in those countries where euthanasia is law. One of the earliest reports came from the Dutch government. Euthanasia was decriminalised in Holland in 2002 after about 20 years of practice under certain guidelines. It was a very honest report for which we were very grateful. Obviously, it was in Dutch, so we had to send it off to get it translated. And when it came back, we actually thought it was a misprint. We didn't think the Dutch government would shoot themselves in the foot like this, but in fact, they did. The 1991 Remmelink report showed that around one third of euthanasia deaths the previous year occurred without the patient's knowledge or consent. That worked out at about 1,000 patients. In Holland, euthanasia was initially intended for those terminally ill patients who were mentally competent and experiencing intolerable suffering at the end of life. By the time the law had passed, the courts had already legitimised the death of patients who were not terminally ill. They then allowed it for people whose suffering was not physical. The first example was a recently bereaved but otherwise healthy woman. Mentally incompetent patients began to receive euthanasia. 12 to 16-year-olds can and do die with parental approval. And the Dutch are currently debating the need to allow people over 70 years of age to receive euthanasia when they are tired of life. And finally, a Dutch hospital has published their guidelines on how to kill disabled newborn babies. The suffering of the parents is taken into account as well as the suffering of the children. And this is what they mean when they talk about a slippery slope. Proponents of euthanasia will tell you that legal guidelines will prevent abuse from happening, but the facts suggest otherwise. No, in each government report since the first one, it keeps reappearing, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 patients each year of euthanasia being performed without the clear and explicit request of the patient. And requests are increasing at the rate of 15% per year. These are some of the references. This is a cartoon that a girl drew. We now have a generation of Dutch who have been educated of the benefits of euthanasia, and people go into the schools to teach the children. This slide shows the proportions from a retrospective study of nursing home deaths. In that sample alone, not all competent patients were consulted, and at least 473 patients were known to be incompetent but still received euthanasia, all under the stringent guidelines in place in Holland. The reason why euthanasia has been given to people who are unable or who unable to request it or who just aren't asked was that the doctor or the family thought the patient would be better off dead. In fact, in the BMJ, there was a study from a UK hospice that showed that there were more relatives than patients in favour of euthanasia. Sadly, the prospect of inheritance brings out the worst in a lot of people. Belgium legalised euthanasia a year after Holland and is going down the same track even more quickly. In 1998, nearly 2,000 people were killed with euthanasia that year without consent, making it more common than euthanasia with consent. And you may have heard that children of any age can now request euthanasia in their country. Even in Australia, we have our own Dr. Death, who's just had his medical registration suspended after helping a man in his 40s to die, and he was not terminally ill. So once you accept this idea that some lives are not worth living, where do you stop? This is the experience of those places where euthanasia has been legalised. Don't count on your doctor being a preserver of life. And it's this evidence of abuse that has been the main reason why governments in many countries, including the UK, Canada, and Australia, have so far rejected calls to legalise euthanasia. There seems to be an attempt to confer medical legitimacy on the ending of life, and it makes you wonder if it feels safer to be killed by someone in a white coat. And I had a funny experience when I was writing this talk in a cafe, and someone asked me what I was doing, and I explained, and she leaned over and she said, "Tell me, when they do that euthanasia, do they sterilise the needle?" It made me realise just how far from current medical practice euthanasia is. But in fact, euthanasia violates medical codes of ethics since antiquity. The Hippocratic Oath, taken by doctors on graduation since the 5th century BC, specifically prohibits doctors from helping their patients to die. So why is it, when an apparently healthy person says they want to die, we rush to intervene and get psychiatric help? But when someone with cancer says they want to die, we try and change the law so their doctor can kill them. The prevalence of depression in advanced disease ranges from 15% to over 30% for all depressive orders. Disorders. In cancer, the rate of depression is around 45%. And one of the symptoms of depression is a desire to end your life. Harvey Chochanov, who works in Winnipeg, has found that requests for euthanasia are closely associated with clinical depression, a potentially treatable illness. Why is this group of patients being treated so differently? Why isn't this a psychiatric emergency? We need more psychiatrists in palliative care. Will euthanasia reduce resources available for palliative care services? It's crazy when you think how much cheaper it is to die in a palliative care unit compared to intensive care, which is often the alternative. In Australia, it's $600 a day versus over $4,000. But it's of even more concern when we realise that patients regularly change their mind about what they want, and that what might seem intolerable at one point may not be so bad further down the track. Think about it from your own point of view. When we're distressed, unwell, under stress, we don't always think clearly. We have good days and bad days. As we go through life, our ideas change. We can't be sure that those people with a death wish, even if they really meant it at the time, would not have changed their mind if only we'd waited a little longer. And we also know that some requests to die are really calls of distress, which have been misinterpreted by health workers. In my experience, that's the overwhelming cause for people to ask for euthanasia. But the main argument the euthanasia lobby has used in its call for euthanasia is that of our need to allow autonomy, the right to choose the timing and the manner of your own death. And I know that this was an important argument behind the Death with Dignity Act in Oregon and Washington. The focus on individual values has become increasingly dominant in our society, and it's at risk of overwhelming our concern for the vulnerable who are at risk of death, which was neither requested nor approved, if you look at the abuse that can occur. So now we have two groups to consider. On the one hand, we have people who have rationally requested euthanasia after all our attempts to help them have not been enough, versus those vulnerable people who are at risk of being killed without their knowledge of consent, as is occurring in Holland. How do we relieve this tension? Well, the way I see it, we do need to respect autonomy, but it's not an absolute value. And autonomy is more than freedom of choice. This argument is based on a view of human beings which is too shallow, devoid of the inevitable social context. Human beings are made for relationship. And our debate is not about whether euthanasia can ever be justified on an individual basis. Of course it can. And quite frankly, if you thought this world was all there was and it wasn't going well for you, why wouldn't you want to request euthanasia? It's also possible to kill yourself if you want to, and sadly, around 3,500 Canadians already do so each year. But we're not talking about individual choices. We're talking about whether we want to make medical homicide legal across the whole community. We have, on the one hand, the small number of dying patients, less than 1%, who ask for euthanasia once palliative care has been tried, and they want autonomy, versus the larger group, maybe not 1,000, but certainly much more than less than 1%, who are at risk of being killed against their will if the government doesn't protect them. Autonomy versus security. Personally, I think our governments have a greater responsibility to ensure public security at the end of life. And I know it's tragic for those people who've requested euthanasia and can't have it. But we must protect those frail and vulnerable patients, patients like mine, who want to live. Now, proponents of euthanasia will reject my reasoning. They say that euthanasia is just an issue between a doctor and their patient, and that it doesn't affect anybody else. But as Professor Margaret Somerville from McGill University has said, legalisation of euthanasia must have a wider impact, because in legalising euthanasia, we're changing one of the most basic tenets of our society, and that is that we do not kill each other, even for reasons of mercy and compassion. So why now? Why are we talking about euthanasia now? What has happened to us as a society? Well, interestingly, for most of human history, a good death was a slow death, which gave one time to prepare and make an orderly exit into the next world. In the Middle Ages, battles were held in the afternoon, which gave the soldiers time to say their prayers and make their peace with God before risking their lives in a fight. But modern Westerners want to die quickly, preferably in their sleep. What has changed? Confrontation with one's own death is known to precipitate an existential crisis, because dying forces us to face the big issues of life. What are we doing here? What is this life all about? And Western society is struggling to answer these questions. We are youth obsessed and death denying. We don't know how to die properly anymore. We are immersed in a culture of comfort and instant gratification. Christians understand the benefits of suffering, such as the opportunity to grow in perseverance, character, and hope, as we're told in Romans 5. But the wider community doesn't share this understanding. Generally, we're not used to suffering, and we find it difficult to tolerate in ourselves or other people. In a society which has lost contact with the meaning of suffering, it has understandably lost their willingness to endure it. But understanding suffering is important, because it may be that what people are requesting in the call for legalised euthanasia is not so much the right to die, but the opportunity to avoid the process of dying itself. Control it with an injection. That way you don't even risk suffering. And I agree that medicine has often failed to relieve suffering. But then suffering at its core is not a medical problem. Suffering is an existential problem which extends beyond physical pain, and it's influenced by psychological, cultural, and spiritual factors. Let me give you an example. Imagine we have two women who are both experiencing the same amount of physical pain. One's in labour, she's having a baby. The other one is dying from cancer. The woman having a baby knows that the reason the pain is there is because the baby's coming out, and soon she hopes to have her newborn baby in her arms, and then the pain will stop. Maybe not soon enough, but it will stop soon. The woman with cancer knows the thing causing the pain is the thing that's killing her, and it's never going to go away. So you can see that even though they are both experiencing the same amount of physical pain, the woman with cancer is suffering more. Often the physical problems can be dealt with and the suffering may well remain. Many people have lost touch with the spiritual before they're facing their own death. And I find that my patients often have no vocabulary to express the distress that they're feeling. This is my area of research, and spirituality in healthcare is a relatively new area of inquiry. This has been to the detriment of the average patient, but its banishment from the clinic goes back a long way. In the 17th century, the French philosopher René Descartes suggested a separation of mind and body on the basis that the body was material and the mind or soul was immaterial, non-material. This dualism made it possible for science to escape the control of the church by assigning the non-physical spiritual realm to the church and leaving the physical domain to science. But it's led to the situation where the whole person, which necessarily incorporates the mind, is not the focus of medicine. Bodies are treated, not persons. Matters such as spiritual suffering are viewed either as subjective and therefore not real, or identified exclusively with bodily pain and somatic symptoms. So when a patient complains of suffering, the doctor's thoughts immediately go to medicines or procedures to fix it up. And this inappropriate focus can lead to treatments which actually increase the suffering of the patient. We know that doctors often mistake the cause of suffering in their patients. I remember looking after a man who was a big Lebanese fellow with a magnificent moustache, and he was the patriarch of his family. And as his cancer continued and he started to shrivel and waste away, he found that his suffering increased. And I remember once going to see him with medical students, and from the end of the bed, you would have thought it was a no-brainer. He could hardly breathe, and you could tell that every time he breathed in, he had a very sharp pain that was causing him distress. So you could have looked at him and say, well, it's obvious why he's suffering. He's suffering from these physical problems. But if you'd sat down and asked him, what causes you distress? He wouldn't have mentioned anything physical. What distressed him was the fact that he'd lost all his authority in his family and nobody took any notice of him anymore. As I told my students, if you want to know the cause of suffering, you have to ask the patient. Now, things are improving. The emotional and psychological are receiving a lot more attention in Western healthcare. The spiritual is the last domain to be addressed, and it hasn't all been plain sailing. Spirituality and religion are often pathologized in medical practice, which has been entrenched since the time of Sigmund Freud, who believed that religion was an expression of underlying psychological neuroses and distress. I think a lot of the problems are partly due to misunderstanding of what spirituality in healthcare is. But it refers to the way patients find meaning and purpose and how they find connectedness to the self, others, the significant, or the sacred. Religion is one type of spirituality, which is formalized and based in a community. But spirituality is understood as a universal human characteristic. So obviously it has many expressions. And spirituality can be understood as the inner life of the person. Research into human spirituality is progressing, and early work in this area demonstrated a link between spirituality and well-being, suggesting that spirituality has a positive impact on social, mental, and emotional health. Now, this is a busy slide, but basically it shows a beneficial relationship between spirituality and stress reduction, relief of depression, recovery from illness, prevention of substance abuse and suicide, heart disease and hypertension, relief of pain, adjustment to disability, recovery from cardiac surgery, longevity, reduced incidence and longer survival with cancer, improved palliative care and counselling outcomes, as well as coping with illness. Benefits are independent of the effects of social support or other factors alone. You knew there was a good reason for going to church, didn't you? Spirituality and religion have also been shown to have a potentially negative effect on health. One of the potential harms is if it leads to a belief that illness is some kind of a punishment, or sometimes beliefs can interfere with treatments, such as patients on Ramadan who are diabetic, not wanting to eat as they should. But evidence suggests that healthcare is enhanced when the doctor's aware of strongly held religious and spiritual beliefs, because by ignoring spiritual issues, we may be separating from patient care what might be the most important part of a person's coping mechanism, integral to their well-being and recovery. So it wouldn't be surprising to know that spirituality plays an important part in the patient experiences of advanced illness. In fact, spirituality has been shown to be a core domain in the assessment of quality of life in cancer patients. A study of cancer patients receiving palliative care, palliative radiotherapy in Boston, showed that 78% of patients regarded religion and or spirituality to be important to their experience. This is a good study. It's a study of patients with advanced lung cancer, and the question was, what are the factors most important in you making your treatment decisions? Now, you can see that both patients and doctors said, well, the first reason why we choose something is because it's going to cure us. And then the second consideration for patients was their trust in God, while doctors, bless them, thought that the patients would next look to their doctor's advice. So it goes to show that all things are brought together by Christ, doesn't it? Who would have thought that human spirituality would turn out to be so important? Now, if you think about the central role of existential suffering in our debate about the end of life care, what does the literature reveal? Well, the modern study of spirituality and suffering has its origins in several ideas. Viktor Frankl was an Austrian psychiatrist who wrote about his experience during internment at Auschwitz concentration camp in World War II. He wasn't surprised that people died. He was surprised that anyone survived. He proposed that suffering could be endured if one saw meaning in life. He found that when suffering had meaning, people could endure. He taught that man's ultimate purpose is not search for power or pleasure, but search for meaning. Dame Cicely Saunders, the founder of the modern hospice movement, studied patient narratives in the 1960s. And when she spoke to them, she found that suffering wasn't just physical, but that social, emotional, psychological, and spiritual factors contributed also. And she called this total pain. Eric Cassell, an American physician, wrote an important paper in 1982 highlighting the effect of the Cartesian dualism on modern medicine, recognizing the need for suffering persons to be seen in their wholeness, to understand the perceived meaning of their suffering. And we're slowly coming to understand what the experience of spiritual suffering entails. Suffering has been defined as an all-encompassing, dynamic, individual phenomenon characterized by the experience of alienation, helplessness, hopelessness, and meaninglessness in the sufferer, which is difficult for them to articulate. It is multidimensional and usually incorporates an undesirable negative quality. It's all-encompassing. It encompasses all areas of life and pervades a person's entire being. It's a subjective experience unique to each individual. The patient experiences alienation. They feel alone, separated from themselves, from their loved ones, and from their personal source of comfort and strength. There's a sense of subjective incompetence and loss of hope and meaning. Suffering is difficult to articulate, and the patient may be unable or just not wanting to express distress in case they distress others. Suffering includes spiritual, physical, cognitive, psychological, social, functional, existential, and mental elements, and has an undesirable negative affective quality, and the intensity of suffering varies over time. Recognition and treatment of suffering will therefore be an important part of medical care. There are limited validated tools to measure it, but we find that there are actually two possible therapeutic responses to suffering. You can treat it, and there are some promising models being developed, or you can prevent it by supporting the patient's spiritual well-being. Suddenly, the whole landscape of terminal illness looks different as we understand that spiritual suffering, the so-called intractable symptom that is at the root of calls for euthanasia, can be addressed in the clinical setting. To help patients move through the existential crisis to a place of peace. The period between diagnosis of a terminal illness and death can be a time of great personal growth. I've seen this time and time again. And this is why so many palliative care workers all around the world are opposed to euthanasia. Parents and families in turmoil, with past hurts and ongoing tensions, can be helped to move through the anguish to a place of peace. We don't discount the pain which the suffering engenders, But we've seen a way through, and death on the other side is a far better place for everyone. Assisted dying is not the only way to relieve suffering. I wouldn't even say it's the best way. Euthanasia is bad for your spiritual journey. Now, this is a Christian conference, so what do Christians have to say about this debate? Well, Christian ethical decision making is grounded in the summary of... Okay, so far my arguments have been the arguments of our community, and the way our community decides what's right from wrong is usually by looking at the consequences of their actions. So if they end up with the outcome they want, they've made the right choice. But Christians have a different way of making ethical decisions. We have a moral compass, which is the Bible. And Christian ethical decision making is grounded in the summary of the commandments given by Jesus in Matthew chapter 22. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, and love your neighbour as yourself. In contrast to the community approach, the Bible doesn't teach that we judge right and wrong on the basis of consequences alone. In ethical decision making, motivation, intention, action, and consequences all matter. Now, we've discussed the most common motivation for those on both sides of the euthanasia debate: compassion for those who suffer. Motivation prompts us to act, but it does not inform the content of our actions. Despite the common motivation, it will not lead to the same actions. And I've argued that euthanasia is an inappropriate response. And this is because there are some things we should never do, regardless of the consequences. The Bible is very clear on euthanasia. We shall not commit murder. Exodus 20, it's one of the Ten Commandments. Our law is based on Judeo-Christian beliefs. And of course, this is precisely why euthanasia has been illegal in this country for so long. In current legal terms, euthanasia is murder which is against the law. In our society, human life is recognised as having an intrinsic value which the state has a duty to protect. It is not overruled by calls for autonomy, for the moment anyway. As we love our neighbours, we recognise that all humans are made in the image of God and so have value which is not dependent on their physical state or their abilities. And I've suggested that the societal consequences for the vulnerable in our society make it too unsafe to allow for the individual choice of euthanasia. And here we have an advantage as Christians. We understand that suffering is inevitable in life because we live in a broken world which has been scarred by sin ever since the fall. There will be no brave new world this side of death, but that doesn't mean we don't care about suffering. In Matthew 5, on the Sermon of the Mount, God calls us to be salt and light, salt to preserve the good in the world and light to illuminate the truth and influence the cultural drift. We need to contribute to the public debate as Christians to protect the vulnerable in our society from the dangers that legal euthanasia will bring. We need to challenge the idea that there are some lives that are not worth living. We also need to continue to care for the sick, supporting palliative care initiatives. But the Christian church has to start treating the disabled and the elderly with the respect they deserve as human beings made in the image of God. It's not because of what they are that they deserve respect. It is because of the God in whose image they are made. And sometimes that means we'll need to be creative in the way we support them and seek solutions. But I think changing the end of life experience is important, and this is a real challenge for our churches. But in the meantime, what do we have to say to those who suffer? That life is a gift from God, and that sometimes it takes less courage to die than to continue living. That while we don't always understand why suffering exists, that we are willing to stay with them because God, in His mercy, created us in community to carry each other's burdens. Because when we are suffering, we are comforted by human presence. Let me give you an example. When Job's friends first saw him, they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. And as Job learnt, it is only God who can give meaning to our suffering. I believe the euthanasia debate is an expression of a society which is struggling to find meaning in life and so finds no meaning in death. They are desperately trying to control it any way they can. But the true answer to our plight as we struggle on in this broken, fallen world is not legalization of euthanasia. It lies in the good news that Jesus came to give us new life, new bodies, better bodies in the world to come, as we read in 1 Corinthians 15. All things hold together in Christ. In Revelation 21, we're told that in the next world, there'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, because in the end, the only thing that can wipe our tears from our eyes is the hand of God. Thank you.
Time for some questions. Please raise your hand. Try to keep your question brief. I'll select the people. Megan will answer. Yes.
Pardon?
Dementia.
Dementia.
So there's nobody home anymore.
Yep. And that person is still made in the image of God.
Is he still there?
Yes. We're told that we're in Genesis 1, we're made in the image of God. Genesis. We are told in Genesis 9:6 that the image of God perseveres after the fall. And we have no reason to think that there's, because the image of God doesn't depend on our own capabilities, but on the nature of God rather than our own nature, that even if we are lacking in any characteristics, including mental competence, we're still made in the image of God. And that's what I meant when I said it's a challenge for the church to start treating elderly people, demented people, with the respect that is deserved of someone who is made in the image of God. Because if the church doesn't respect people with dementia, how can we expect the general community to? And while we might think that those with dementia have nothing to offer, or that there's nobody home, I actually, my employer does some very innovative work with dementia patients. And we find that if someone has a positive experience with a loved one coming to visit them, even if they don't show any recognition that that loved one is there, the nursing staff notices an improvement in their general being. They are just happier and more settled. Than if they have someone who, for example, is cranky with them. And it's interesting to see that as we get older, we become more like the person we truly are. And in dementia patients, that's even more magnified. And wouldn't it be wonderful if Christians, as they become demented, become just more and more in the image of Christ? And that I have seen that happen. And I think that we can witness to a merciful and loving God, even when we have dementia. And I think that we need to start seeing the positive ways that people with dementia can minister to us. And dementia is not an all or nothing thing either. It's a much more nuanced experience until someone gets to the very final stages. But I think we have to stop thinking that the value of a human being depends on what they can do. It's who they are, and who, but in particular, whose image they reflect, that we have to remember.
Listening to what you're saying, is it that the the most important issue in Western society is the crumbling of community and the isolation that comes with individuals.
Did you all hear the question? Sorry, I should have asked before. I'll repeat the question. Sorry, I should have done that last time as well. Is the main problem in Western society the crumbling of community and the rise of individualism? That was the question. I certainly think that's part of the problem because people who are at the end of life are very much comforted by human presence, and dying is a much more difficult process if you're on your own and nobody actually cares whether you're there or not. But I really think that what makes it even harder is the way Western society denies the existence of spirituality as a dimension of the human being. Euthanasia is not a huge debate in the developing world. And they have a lot more reason to want euthanasia than we do when you actually think about what experience they have at the end of life in countries like, you know, Southern Africa. But I think a lot of what we see as suffering at the end of life is spiritual suffering. But if you've denied that you have a spiritual nature, you are completely at a loss when suddenly it comes upon you and you have no idea what's going on, which I see in my patients. And I think that even though I believe that Christianity is the true answer to this plight, that even steps towards human beings realizing there is a spiritual dimension is a step in the right direction. But it's that complete inability to understand that they have a spiritual nature and the reason they are suffering, regardless of their physical condition, is because they are trying to find a meaning in their existence, which they've never really thought about before. And I think that as we can get the idea that the spiritual dimension is a legitimate part of the human being, I think we will see a much more nuanced debate.
Yeah. No, right here at the front. You.
Yeah.
It really fits with what you're saying.
I did provide some references which will be on the web because I expected some people to disagree with me. The question was, are there references for what's happening in Holland? Because the lady in the audience said that she has personal contacts in Holland, a village in Holland. They don't send the elderly to hospital because they worry they don't come back. I had a long conversation with a member of the Dutch Euthanasia Society in Holland last year. They actually don't define suffering in their legislation. Suffering is, if you say you're suffering, you're suffering. There are no objective guidelines. And as I said, that's the first step. But the second step is once doctors start getting into the habit of thinking that some lives aren't worth living, it's, as I said, it's going up at 15% per year, euthanasia in Holland. But there are lots of references here. Part of the legislation, there has to be a yearly report published on what's happening.
Okay, we'll take one there and then over here.
Projecting now, and people still think it's care for end of life since last few days.
So the comment was that as a palliative care physician working in Canada, no, a palliative care nurse, very important palliative care nurses, fabulous people. Even though have we failed in palliative care because it has been around for decades, not too many decades, certainly in Australia, and still the general public think it's just about the last few days of life and they don't realise it's about maximising quality of life. We used to say, we'll help you live until you die. It's about maximising quality of life from the time that you know you have a terminal illness until the time of death. And that there is a national strategy for palliative care has been proposed for Canada. I think that education needs to continue to be attempted with the general public. I would never have believed 20 years ago that I would still be having to say to people, morphine, you can give someone morphine and it doesn't shorten their life. There are taxi drivers on morphine. That shouldn't horrify you. They're perfectly okay. I think part of the problem is that the reason I started my talk with definitions and really spent a long time just blow by blow explaining what the debate's about is because there's so much confusion in the community about end of life issues. And some of that has been purposely done by the pro-euthanasia lobby. If you look at some of the legislation in the US, if you wanted to support adequate pain control, it would be on the same bill as the support of euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide. This crazy legislation in Quebec, pardon me if you're from Quebec, it's just to say that to mix palliative care treatment and physician-assisted suicide so closely, I just think is really unhelpful and will make people perhaps to be scared of palliative care if they think that it's going to come as a package. But I think that we need to just keep educating people and start talking about death because it's still taboo in Western society. And if we don't talk about it, it will remain something that we're all fearful of. But if we can start to talk about it more and start finding out what options are available, and the reason I put up that advanced care planning website is so that to encourage you to look at it and start to talk to your family about what your preferences are, so that at the end of life, people aren't in this dreadful situation where they don't know what to do and they just can clearly tell doctors what your preferences were. Advanced care planning in itself is a whole talk, but I'm sure if we talk about it more, it will become less fearful and people can discover their options. Sorry, long answer.
Yeah, thank you.
This is follow up to the previous question. Nigel Cameron's book, The New Medicine,
is yep.
A very detailed study in terms of the Netherlands, what's going on there, as well as the
Nigel is certainly a great champion. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, do we have way over here? Yeah.
Well, I think that there is several different, the question was, what are the options for local churches in this whole thing? I think that if we activate the church community to be more supportive of people at the end of life so that the end of life experience can become less scary. I certainly know some people in churches have come up to me and said when someone in their family was dying, they'd be walking along a street and someone from their church would see them and cross over so they didn't have to talk to them because they didn't know what to say. But it doesn't matter what you say. Even if you just walk up to them and burst into tears, they'll really appreciate it. We have to realise that death is an enemy. God didn't intend for death to be part of our experience. In the new world, when we're not going to have to deal with death anymore. Death is an enemy, but it's an enemy who's been defeated. And when we go to the next life, of course there'll be sadness at leaving our loved ones, but death will be a gain in many ways when we go to live with our fathers. So Christians of all people should be able to talk about death. And there are some books coming out now talking about very positive experiences of dying. If we can start being more involved in each other's final days, it can become part of our everyday experience again, and it doesn't become such a foreign idea. I think that it has a lot of practical benefits if we can start to be involved with families who are coping with someone dying in their midst. But I think it would help ourselves when our time is coming as well, because I think we could learn to die from example. We just haven't seen examples. I think volunteers in local hospice programs are very important. Most hospices rely heavily on volunteers. And what a great opportunity for witnessing to someone who is searching for meaning in life. My father became a Christian 3 years before he died because of a Christian ministering to him at a time when he was searching for meaning. I'm not saying that everybody is going to turn around and become Christian, but we're certainly in a great position to start talking about what life is all about, and I think that that's certainly a role for the church as well. And I think at this time when Quebec has legalised euthanasia, it wouldn't hurt to encourage your church members to write to their local members of parliament to just let members of parliament know that not everybody is in favour of euthanasia.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Yep.
So one thing that you started with, you didn't directly address, is the question of culpability and how does that inform our public policy? I mean, is the church really in a position where we need to be telling people what decisions they, telling secular people what decisions they can and can't make? And especially when it is a subject of some debate, very little probably, but some debate within the church.
Are we culpable for people's death?
If we help them make, if we let them make the decision, does that make us responsible for their death indirectly?
Make what decision?
Well, I think he's asking two things. One is, what right does the church have to tell society how we should decide on this issue? And second, if we let them decide autonomy, is the church responsible? Are Christians responsible?
If we let them, that second bit I just don't
suppose
get.
We. Say, okay, secular society, you have this law.
Yeah.
Are we complicit in allowing this death? I think that's what he means.
The first part of the question, as I understand it, is does the church have any right to have a say in the public debate about euthanasia? Is that correct? Is that... I'm happy with radical. I just want to understand. I just want to answer what you're actually asking. Should we impose something which is a matter of debate in the church on people who are not in the church?
And the second question is, are we guilty? Are we culpable for allowing that if we're not making a decision ourselves?
Well, firstly, does the church have any place to be involved in the public debate about euthanasia if the church as a whole doesn't really agree on what they think about euthanasia? Is that part A? There are no dumb questions. As a Christian, we have the instruction book from the Creator on what's best for human flourishing. We say Christ holds all things together. In my career in bioethics, I've never found a biblical instruction which was contravened by research. But we have as much say as anybody. Everyone has a say in a democracy. Christians don't have less of a say than anybody else. As I said, I'm biased. I think we have a better opinion than a lot of other people. But everyone can have a say, including us. And why is the conservative position always necessarily wrong? I think that people who say that there is no danger in euthanasia laws should be in the position to prove their case rather than those of us who say, you know, watch out. I think that... As Christians, we are often scared to speak up because We know that there will be opposition, but we have as much right to have a say as anybody. And I think that we should get over our hang-ups and start saying what we really think as part of the community, as part of our responsibility to speak up in the public square. Not everybody shares our views, but gee, I don't share the views of everyone else speaking up, so let me have my chance to say my bit. So I think that the church has as much right to have a say as anybody. And it will be individuals talking to their individual MPs. There will be some churches who can make a statement on behalf of all their members, but you're right, there are some churches which will not come to a consensus, and in which case individuals will have to speak up, but if they want to. But why not speak up? I don't think that we're imposing our ideas on anyone else any more than they're imposing their ideas on me. You know, part of my tax money goes towards funding abortions, and which I object to very much, but we live in a democracy. The person with the most votes wins, and that's something we all have to live with, but at least let's have our say. The second one was, are we culpable if other people make a decision which we don't agree with? I think that if somebody makes a decision, if we are part of a society which passes a law for euthanasia, are we culpable if someone makes a decision? I think that, once again, we have a responsibility to make ourselves held. We are called to be faithful, not to be successful. If we are faithful in saying what we believe is true, and in a democracy a vote is taken and our side doesn't win, that's part of being in a democracy, and we haven't failed as Christians if we did say what we thought was true. And we should never be scared of failure. We know that things are going to go very badly wrong in this world before Jesus comes back. And he doesn't expect us to win all the wars, he just expects us to be faithful, and I'm sure we can do that.